Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Gar, and my guest is Dr. Lee Goldman. He's the author of a book called Too Much of a Good Thing. And what he is talking about here is kind of a radical new explanation for the prevalence of disease in our modern world. Things that, well, situations that worked for us 200,000 years ago, like the ability to store fat and excess fat, and also the craving for salt and water, and also our fight or flight protection mechanisms. These types of things allowed us to survive 200,000 years ago. Now they are responsible directly for more than 40% of deaths in the US, whereas our appetites now need to go the opposite directions, where we need to eat less, and because we don't have to store so much fat. And diets are actually antigenetic. They don't even make sense to our genetics. We don't need as much salt and water because we have modern day cooling mechanisms such as air conditioning, and we don't need to store so much salt and sweat as much. So now that salt turns into high blood pressure effects, and for about 30% of Americans, fear and violence. When before we had the fight or flight mechanism, and now we have depression, anxiety, PTSD, which accounts for suicides. And these are actually there are more deaths that are caused by suicide than there are by any type of a fight or flight predator type of situation these days. Next, we're going to be talking about the ability to form blood clots and how our superb blood clotting system saved our ancestors from hemorrhaging. And those are very common causes of deaths back then, and especially during childbirth. And now that same clotting system has led to the epidemic of heart disease and strokes. So we're going to come back with Too Much of a Good Thing, Lee Goldman, talking about this. And then we're going to get into what this information and this awareness gives us, and how we can use this information to make significant changes in our lives. So we will be right back. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Gar. My guest is Dr. Lee Goldman. We're talking about too much of a good thing, too much fat, too much salt, water, too much fear. These are all leading to 40% of deaths in the US. What about And these things worked for us 200,000 years ago when our DNA was forming, and 10,000 generations as we slowly evolved out of it. But in the last 200 years, so much has changed. So much change has occurred. Our DNA can't quite catch up. So, Lee, can you talk to us about the fourth key in the four survival traits that are now killing us, the ability to form blood clots?
Sure. So we have a remarkably complex clotting system. It includes two sets of proteins, each with up to 10 or more different proteins that act in sequence like a cascade, as well as our platelets. To give you an idea of how important these systems are, people who don't have that full cascade of proteins are, for example, people with hemophilia, people who bleed excessively whenever they're injured. And until recently, with the availability of replacement factors, commonly bled to death and died in infancy or young adulthood. And people who don't have enough platelets also bleed too much and can even bleed spontaneously, sometimes into their brains. So having enough of those clotting proteins, and the platelets are little clotting cells, is really critical. We talked before about how many humans died of violence. Well, if you cut yourself or got hit and you couldn't clot, you'd either bleed to death externally or develop bleeding internally. For example, if you bleed maybe half a cup of blood into your brain, it'll kill you because there's no room for the normal brain tissue. So being able to clot, really, really critical. And in fact, as you indicated, perhaps the most obvious time is after childbirth. People will remember that when a woman delivers, she not only delivers the baby, but afterwards, often called the afterbirth, which is the placenta. The placenta is what nourishes the baby. It's attached to the inside of the uterus. And when the placenta breaks off, the inside of a woman's uterus looks no different than if you took someone's knee and dragged it across the sidewalk. It's just all full of areas where it could bleed, just like any kind of deep abrasion. So we have to be able to clot and clot quickly, or they would die from bleeding after childbirth. And in fact, historically, what's called postpartum hemorrhage, bleeding to death after childbirth, was one of the common causes of maternal mortality. The reason women don't bleed to death is those clotting proteins, those platelets, they rush in and they help seal off all those little bleeding blood vessels, and the mother doesn't bleed to death. This system is really critical, but it has to be well balanced, because after all, we have about 10 pints of blood, plus or minus, flowing through our arteries and veins, and if they clot, then bad things happen. If you get a clot in the artery that supplies blood to your heart, that causes a heart attack. A clot in the artery supplying blood to your brain, that causes a stroke. A clot in the veins in your legs causes swelling in your legs. And if that clot breaks off and goes to your lungs, it's what's called a pulmonary embolus, and that can also kill you. So our clotting system was really well designed for the challenges, you know, of the Stone Age. Don't bleed to death. Don't bleed to death. Don't bleed to death. It wasn't made necessarily for the challenges we face today. And really, two things have changed. One, I'll start off with the less severe, but in some ways easier to understand, veins, the veins in your legs, for example. When we were vigorous and active, the risk of forming blood clots in your veins really very, very low. But now you'll hear about people who get blood clots in their veins after long car rides or airplane trips because we simply sit around too much. So our veins were really designed to get that blood back up to our heart, where it could be pumped out again, in part because as the muscles in our legs would contract, that would kind of push the blood up the veins against gravity up to our heart. But if we sit around all day, sit in a plane for hours, sit in the car for hours, we can develop clots in our legs, causing swelling, but even more worrisome, as I said, the possibility when those clots will break loose and go to our lungs and kill us. On the artery side, supplying the blood that keeps our vital organs alive, a big difference today is we do live longer, but we also develop narrowings in those arteries to our heart.
Because of number one, because of the fat.
Those are the fatty deposits, the so-called atherosclerosis, plaques, and those plaques narrow the arteries. But interestingly, what causes oftentimes the acute heart attack or stroke is that that plaque, that fatty deposit, ruptures. And it ruptures inside the artery. So think of this not as bleeding outside the artery, but a tear inside the artery. But the natural thing that our body does when there's a little tear on the inside layer of the artery is it tries to heal it. It tries to form a clot so that that blood vessel doesn't leak on the inside. The little tiny parts of the capillaries are sometimes called arterioles. So we actually form a clot not on the outside of the artery to protect us from bleeding out, but on the inside of the artery to heal that inside layer. That clot can get big enough to block the artery and cause a heart attack or stroke.
Right.
So here we have a clotting system beautifully designed for the challenges of the very olden days, but not well designed for today, partly because of physical activity, but in terms of real deaths, largely because we now live long enough and eat differently and gain weight and obesity and diabetes, that we develop these plaques atherosclerotic plaques on the inside of our arteries,
So
and that's what kills us.
it's fascinating that these things that were part of our very survival 200,000 years ago now are attributing to about 40% of the deaths in the US. So awareness is key, and we understand this, but then how do we work against these genetics that are ingrained in us?
Sure. So first of all, let me say that some of this is the price of success. So many things I've talked about wouldn't be a problem if human life expectancy were 33 years. So human life expectancy was about 33 years in the Stone Age, in the Middle Ages, and in Europe up until about 1850. And if that was our average life expectancy, all these traits are good rather than bad. What's happened is that in the past 150 years, life expectancy is well more than doubled. So now that we live longer, the balance between benefit and harm has really tilted. But now something even worse is happening, and you've seen some of this in the newspapers recently. Here in America, life expectancy, especially for people of lower socioeconomic classes, especially whites, is declining. Declining in women, declining in men. So for the first time, other than perhaps things like the AIDS epidemic or things of that sort, we see a decline in life expectancy because these traits are now killing people a bit earlier. They're not killing people typically in their 20s and 30s before they have kids, but they're killing us in our 50s, 40s, rather than our 70s and 80s. So this is worrisome. Now, if in fact these diseases would start to kill us in our 20s, then there would be a huge evolutionary benefit to the people who didn't have them. All the people who got obese, got diabetes, had high blood pressure, got anxious and depressed, or had diseases of clotting, if they all died in their 20s before they had kids who had kids, then evolution would fix us. But even with the decline in life expectancy of, a year or two, we're nowhere close to having that kind of a phenomenon. And hopefully we'll never even come close to that. So unless something like that happens, our genes won't change. They certainly won't change fast enough. Now, people also talk about, well, you've heard about epigenetics, the influence of environment on our genes. Could that have a role here? Well, maybe, but there's certainly no evidence of that at the moment. Otherwise, life expectancy in some of these poor parts of the U.S. wouldn't be getting shorter. In fact, in some parts of the U.S., life expectancy is as
It's
long as
longer.
anywhere in the world. Other parts of the U.S., life expectancy rivals Bangladesh. That gives you an idea of the disparities in America. But even in Bangladesh, we're not going to, people aren't dying early enough, thankfully, for evolution per se to cure these things. So it's exceedingly unlikely that we will ever evolve out of this. And if we did, it would really be pretty awful.
Well, could this amount of awareness about starting with the diets, could we understand that there, if we just simply went through this understanding that there is food everywhere, we don't have to store food in our bodies as fat any longer, and we can eat lighter and be more agile and have more exercise so that the salt can release and the water can release from our body, and meditate and go through more practices. I mean, could this really truly?
it's hypothetically possible.
It is.
The question is how likely. So I'll give you
How
a
disciplined.
little bit of, what I'll call hope, and then dash most of that hope.
Oh, thank you.
So
It's a positive guy.
the hope comes from, if you remember the pictures of American presidents in the late 1900s and up to William Howard Taft, it was the late 1800s and early 1900s. So starting with those guys like Chester Arthur, who you may very vaguely remember, American presidents were really fat. And it peaked with William Howard Taft, elected in 1908. He weighed more than 350 pounds. This was a time when wealthy Americans were seeing the benefits of the Industrial Revolution. They were the first to have access to tremendous amounts of food, to benefit from some of the work-saving inventions of the Industrial Revolution. William Howard Taft, by the way, is a good example of some of the problems, though. He struggled to lose weight while he was president. In fact, at one point, he consulted with the most famous diet doctor of the time, who was in England, and who put him on a diet that Taft tried to follow. But Taft, even though he was president, later became Supreme Court judge, did what most people did. He lied about his weight. So he really didn't lose the weight he was telling the doctor he was losing. But nevertheless, we went from Americans and wealthy people being the fattest to wealthy people being thinner. And perhaps the best example is Wallis Simpson, for whom the King of England gave up the throne. She was famous for saying, "You can never be too rich or too thin." So we had a time when wealthy people were very fat, then got thinner. In America today, people of lower socioeconomic classes tend to be the fattest and the most obese. We're seeing it spread to the middle class, upper middle class, and beyond. In most other parts of the world, the obesity epidemic is predominantly in the middle and upper classes, where it's a sign of wealth and prosperity. A couple of years ago, I was visiting a very poor sub-Saharan African country, and I met with the eight leading people in the health ministry, the eight leading people responsible for the health of the country. Again, where HIV and AIDS was seen about 20-25% of the population. Of these eight leading people, three or four of them were frankly obese.
Wow.
The others, except for one, were all overweight. The only person who wasn't obviously overweight or obese was someone who had had diabetes. So in that country, overweight people, obese people actually do live longer than skinny people because skinny people have AIDS. Being overweight is a sign of prosperity, a
I
sign you
see.
don't have AIDS. So in much of the world, obesity is a sign of,
Right,
being wealthy and
prosperity.
prosperous. And obese people live longer than skinny people. Now, obese people don't live longer than equally rich skinny people, but obese people still live longer than skinny people. And here in America, we see this remarkable increase in weight. I mean, if one simply looks at pictures of crowds around the time of the end of World War II, just look at the pictures in the crowds. There aren't heavy people there.
Right. True.
You look at
True.
pictures of crowds in those same places, Times Square or whatever today, and people are just so much heavier. This is not something that comes as a surprise to anyone. We gain weight as we age. The average American gains about a pound a year after age 30 or so. We don't gain weight, usually much faster than that. It's just a very gradual process. And if you do the arithmetic,
Is that just metabolism?
well, no, it's about an extra 50 to 100 calories a day every day,
So it's
4 years.
actually lifestyle.
So you don't have to be off by that much. And in fact, look, it's not hard to find a scone or a muffin that has 350 or 500 calories in it. You don't
And there
have
were no fast food restaurants back
to. That's
in.
right. So it's so easy now to gain weight, and people do it gradually. Could all this stop? Could we become
Disciplined.
more disciplined? Well, I go back to what I said earlier during the first hour. If I had a way to make this work, we wouldn't see obesity in 35% of Americans, and the number's still going up. We wouldn't see weight increasing everywhere in the world. Even in sub-Saharan Africa now, if you look at the pregnant mothers, expectant mm-hmm. mothers, more are overweight than underweight. It's really remarkable. So I don't want to say, they say never say never. So it is possible that we will all become more disciplined. We will all somehow fight our genes, as you said. We will stop overeating. We'll exercise more.
Awareness does help.
Reduce our salt intake. We'll meditate and be happy. We'll exercise and not clot.
Oh, 1 second. Dr. Goldman, we're going to come back and take some phone calls when we come back. This is Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. We will be right back with Dr. Lee Goldman. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Gar, and we will be back with my guest, Dr. Lee Goldman, to find some solutions to too much of a good thing. In the meantime, I encourage you to check out the Coast to Coast website. If you go to coasttocoastam.com, you can look up George's events. He's got an event coming up in June 18th in St. Louis, and he is going to be streaming that live, actually, as well. If you have not, if you can't get to the area, then you can watch it live online. So you can check that out there as well. George and I both have TV shows on the Gaia Network. You could check out George's show at beyondbelief.com or my show at lisasinspirations.com. And I also want to let you know that I am also speaking in Massachusetts this coming weekend, the 17, 18, 19, at Kripalu, which is a retreat center. And I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Bruce Lipton about cellular biology and epigenetics. That's coming up this weekend. You can find out about that at my website, which is theawareshow.com. It's my daily radio show. And we will be right back with Dr. Lee Goldman on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Gar. My guest is Dr. Lee Goldman. We're talking about too much of a good thing. And Lee, we're going to go to phone calls. Is that good with you?
Sure.
Great. So we've got Thomas calling from La Jolla, California. Thomas, do you have a question for Dr. Lee Goldman?
Good morning, Lisa. It's always a pleasure to hear your guest hosting on Coast to Coast.
Thank you.
And Lee Goldman, I'm very impressed, and I'm definitely going to buy your book. My question for you, Dr. Goldman, is about adrenaline and our society's addiction to adrenaline and adrenaline rushes. Back in the Paleolithic age, adrenaline was something that you experienced maybe 5 or 6 times in your life when you were facing a warrior or facing a saber-toothed tiger, you know, fight or flight. But today, adrenaline is a daily thing in our society, from the cup of coffee that we take in the morning. Normal sports, normal exercise has turned into extreme sports, addiction to adrenaline. Or, you know, movies have gone from like The Sound of Music to very violent, one adrenaline rush after another. Normal kids' games have turned into violent video games. In other words, as Marilyn Barrick, a famous psychologist, said, America is on an adrenaline high. Not the 5 or 6 times in your entire life when you depended on adrenaline for fight or flight, but it becomes a daily thing. So my question for you, Dr. Goldman, is adrenaline rushes, is that too much of a good thing?
Good question.
Sure. Let me perhaps put in a somewhat different perspective. I wasn't around in the Paleolithic era, but my guess is that my ancestors back then had adrenaline rushes a lot more often than 5 or 6 times in their lifetime. That dangers they faced were daily, not every 5 or 10 years. And that adrenaline rush was a recurrent event. I would say what's different is that those adrenaline rushes were truly driven by survival needs. That adrenaline rush was not artificial. It wasn't hypothetical. It wasn't based on movies. It wasn't based on anything else other than the true need to survive. So that adrenaline rush is extraordinarily protective, and it's critical to our survival. What's different now is that we don't really face those same kinds of dangers on a regular basis. So we don't have the same intrinsic regular need to pump out that adrenaline to save us. But we do have other things that may trigger adrenaline rushes that we don't really need. I'm not sure how counterproductive that is in the long run, because those adrenaline rushes probably saved our ancestors. They didn't kill them. But I would certainly agree with you that there are lots of things in modern life that give us unnecessary adrenaline rushes, as opposed to ones that truly are needed for our survival. What I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows, is whether what we're doing with movies and other things is sort of keeping that system alive and awake, and maybe that isn't so bad, because you want to have that adrenaline reserve when you actually need it, even in modern society.
What about adrenal burnout, where we just get burnt out?
It's very, 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 very unusual. There are very rare cases where people may have had true crises that led their adrenal glands to burn out. But adrenal burnout is very, very uncommon. And when we see it, it's almost always related to an autoimmune condition, not dissimilar to rheumatoid arthritis or type 1 diabetes or multiple sclerosis, where our body seems to destroy the adrenal gland for no good reason. So, except in rare circumstances, and the main place where that's been seen is in women during delivery, when their blood pressures fall and they have this extraordinary need for adrenaline to try to save them. But it's really very, very uncommon.
Interesting. So, well, thank you for the question, Thomas. I appreciate it. It definitely has it brings up a lot of concerns and questions about autoimmune diseases and how that would affect us. I don't think there was such a thing as autoimmune diseases in the Paleolithic age.
Well, there may have been. I think what we see now is that if you add in the true autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, type 1 diabetes, some kinds of other diseases, plus, for example, asthma and allergies, those things all add together are now a substantive issue. In fact, if you look at, they're more common in women, I can get back into that in a moment. In some developed countries now, there's suggestions that the combination of all the allergic and immunologic diseases may actually kill more people than infections do. That's quite a shift from where we were in the Paleolithic era.
Yes.
Whether those diseases were around then or not, we don't really know, since many of them tend to get worse as we get older.
We have names for them now, yes.
They're more of an issue now than it was before. A lot of speculation that you could reduce the risk of childhood asthma by exposing kids to more dirt and dust. But the interventional studies that have tried to do that really haven't panned out. It may well be that the kinds of things we need to be exposed to, like worms and parasites, are not things we'd like to expose our children to these days.
Interesting. But we do expose them to genetically modified foods and so forth.
We do, but there's no evidence that those are the causes of these diseases, I'll say.
Right. Well, but there is evidence that there are allergies to them in people.
This is going to go way beyond my book. We have allergies to everything.
Right. Okay. Okay. Got it. Okay. Let's talk with, sorry, Robert in Illinois. We've got wild card line four. How are you, Robert?
Thank you. Thank you all. Doctor, what is your opinion on taking apple cider vinegar and krill oil? Do they really help you at all?
No evidence.
No evidence.
There are lots of vitamins, minerals, oils, motions, potions, and lotions that people can try. Very little for which there's evidence of benefit. I would say if you're looking for something and you're, by the sound of your voice, probably male, and you may or may not be over the age of 50 or 60, we get into things like low-dose aspirin that probably do work. But I would say that before filling up your body with lots of supplements, I'd really encourage people to look carefully at the medical evidence to see where these things are more beneficial than harmful. One of the things we have to be careful about is if you look at many of these options, we see them as major reasons why people come into emergency rooms with complications. There are some that cause liver damage. I would just want people to be very careful about the supplements and other things they've taken. In general, suggest that you talk to your doctor before you take things like that, just to be sure that you can be confident there are no side effects.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Well, thank you for your phone call. Let's see. We've got Annie calling from Alabama, wild card line three. Hi, Annie.
Thank you. I hope my laryngitis is not too bad. Now, Doc, in rebuilding heart tissue, damage from heart failure with low ejection fraction, is there anything to any of these theories that this tissue can be rebuilt and get the heart back up to normal, especially with clonidine to stimulate release of GHR, the growth hormone releasing hormone, which then in turn stimulates growth hormone? Does that do anything? And how about stem cells and eating protein? What do you know that really works?
Sure. I had trouble hearing all your comments, but I will. I think you were mainly asking about growth hormone and the stem cell therapy. Lots of excitement about the possibility that growth hormone would turn all of us back into teenagers. Little, if any, evidence that it does any good. Certainly there are potential side effects. So I would say that unless there's evidence of growth hormone deficiency, which is unusual, that there's no evidence this is going to be the anti-aging cure or the way to regenerate heart muscle. There's been a lot of study of using stem cells to try to repair hearts that are damaged by heart attacks or by intrinsic muscle disease and heart failure. And many of these have purported to show benefits, but at this point, none of them have stood the test of time. So we'll periodically see a very exciting report suggesting that this or that kind of stem cells injected this way or that way seem to make people a little bit better, but when repeated by other researchers, they have not been validated. So at this point, in my mind, there's no evidence that a stem cell therapy is beneficial. That doesn't mean there isn't potential hope down the line, but at this point, it's not.
In the U.S., at least, as far as you know, right?
Anywhere. I mean, there have been more experiments in other countries that have different thresholds for allowing experiments in humans. And some of the early reports of benefit came from some of those countries. Many of those are 10, 15 years ago. but they really haven't held up. So we have to be careful here about, hope, if you will, versus real evidence of benefit.
What would you test that against if you were to read some statistics that came in from another party? How would you verify that? What would you?
Well, so one of the things you really want to look at in science is the reproducibility. So it's a big issue now in scientific experimentation, whether it's in animals or even studies in humans. If something looks like it's positive, people get very excited. It tends to get published pretty quickly, and there's a lot of hype around it. What you really want to look at is, do these things get validated in subsequent studies by other unbiased individuals using high-quality scientific standards, if you will, that include people being blinded, so you don't have the placebo effect. You don't know which treatment you're getting.
Uh-huh.
And so we see a number of things that look promising and then don't hold up. Some of the estimates are that anywhere from 10 to 50% of reports you see may not hold up when they're subject to further validation.
Hmm.
So I think we just have to be careful here, and people can quickly be misled. Everyone's always looking for hope. And I really want to distinguish things that truly work from things that don't. So, for example, it may seem unpopular with some of your viewers, your listeners, but statins are really good. And in the modern world, back to some of the things we talked about, statins are an extremely effective way to prevent the progression of atherosclerosis, to reduce the risk of heart disease and strokes. There are some
side effects.
Small numbers of patients who develop side effects, but overwhelmingly, these medications actually work, and in very large studies replicated around the world, people live longer. So I think we have to be careful here. It's so easy to get excited or distracted by the success that isn't replicated, or distracted by the occasional person who may truly have a bad side effect of beneficial medication. But if there's one thing I want people to take away from my book, it's that things like cholesterol reduction with statins, things like lowering your blood pressure, they really work. They really save people. And the fears, and it's true that occasional people do have side effects, but for people to be scared away from these beneficial treatments because of the occasional side effect, that's really a tragedy. These things really work.
They do have a lot more funding behind them in terms of studies to validate their efficacy, and that does help a lot because there's a lot of research that is able to be done because of the FDA. And it requires that amount of research to be done, right?
Right. For these things to be approved,
the
standards are pretty high. Now, I'm not going to say that everything that every pharmaceutical company does is good. I am trying to say that if you look at the things that actually are proven to reduce the burden of the things I talk about in this book, the best things right now are statins to reduce the levels of LDL or bad cholesterol and to significantly reduce the risk of heart attack, reduce the risk of stroke in people who need them, and make people live longer. The same thing is true with blood pressure medications. They lower your blood pressure, and people have less strokes, less heart attacks, and live longer. These are treatments that truly are beneficial, and I think in many ways are the harbinger of more things like that will truly work.
Even
example I use in the book, if I may just briefly, is a woman in Dallas who was discovered to have an LDL bad cholesterol level of 14, the lowest people had ever really seen in the Western world. She's missing both copies of a gene that helps you make LDL cholesterol, and she's perfectly normal. She's an example of people, rare people, who don't have genes that most of the rest of us have, genes we no longer need, and genes we're unlikely to get rid of by natural selection, but can potentially blunt with appropriate medication.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the interview tonight. And the name of the book is Too Much of a Good Thing. Thank you so much, Dr. Lee Goldman. And I want to thank you so much for listening. Lisa Lyon, thank you. And George Norrie, Tommy Danheiser, Gina Salvati. Thank you, Jeff Engineering here at Coast to Coast, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros. And thank you for listening. It is your energy that makes these shows happen, and your calls and all of your great inquiries during the shows. Thank you so much for keeping us alive at Coast to Coast AM. And until next time, I invite you to stay aware.